Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm very excited to have as my guest Eileen Miles. Her novel, Inferno, is a poet's novel. It's also a memoir, autobiography, modeled on Dante's Inferno, or at least the three parts of it. And it's hilarious, it's moving, it's readable and terrific. It's published by Or Books. You can read about it at orbooks.com. A poet's novel. Mm-hmm. What's that?
I mean, I guess in a way it's like telling you that something is handmade, that this is not a machine-made novel. This is not a novel that feels deeply familiar and that you've read it before, that it might stop and start. It might take leaps like poetry does. In a way, I mean, I think because there is a tendency to call a novel that uses the author's own name a memoir, and yet I wanted to say there was some in-between steps between novel and memoir, and specifically because this one is about the kind of existence of a character, the poet, that the form is indeed that too.
And I think no one really knows what a poet's life is.
Exactly, exactly.
And you also go backwards. You write the context of some of your most famous poems.
Uh-huh.
So we get, like, the history of what happens when a poet writes, and just the mere fact of their writing turns into a story.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like, you have a famous poem in which, out of the blue, you announce that you're a Kennedy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we're finding out how that poem came to be written. And, of course, despite the Boston accent, you're not a Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
But in another way, everyone in America is a Kennedy.
Exactly.
Or was.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. It's like the fiction of poetry, because what if the poet was a Kennedy? You know, what if a Kennedy was a lesbian? What would be the difference? And standing in the position of the 80s, that was kind of a very direct route to being politically viable, you know, in the same way that growing up as a poet, I was friends with Allen Ginsberg. And it was always clear that in his time, he was the only poet who would ever be asked by the larger culture where he weighed in on things. And even if he wasn't asked, he would let you know. There was that sense of the poet as a heroic in a certain sense. So when I stumbled upon writing that poem, and it definitely traded on some thoughts I already had about how a person from a lower class background could purport to be a person from an upper class background, or a person who had the leisure to do something as kind of unbelievable as being a poet as a life choice. So the performance of writing the poem gave me a sudden access to what political freedom would feel like, what it would feel like to have a mouthpiece to a larger culture. And suddenly the political entered into my poetry in a new way. So it was a poem that changed my life. And so it seemed it behooved me as a poet novelist to put that in the institution of the novel and make its lineage clear.
Well, what's so great is that in this book there are around 8 different versions of going to college, leaving to college, going to graduate school,
uh-huh.
leaving graduate school.
Right.
And everyone is afraid nowadays that if they haven't been in graduate school, then they can't make it as a poet.
Right.
And that's part of it, too,
mm-hmm.
that sense that all sorts of, like, how smart do you have to be, you know, and
mm-hmm.
do you have to be smart at all? And all sorts of different poetic traditions enter. What is yours?
It might be the tradition that decides that to dedicate your life to poetry is kind of like jumping off a cliff, and that's a good thing. You know, I mean, literally, when I remember coming to New York to be a poet and briefly being in graduate school and how momentous and scary it was to step away from the institution and say, no, I'm really just doing this, you know. But really, that was the feeling of the world that I was in as a poet. I love to tell people who weren't there then what it was like to be around for a while and then meet older people. And a little while later, those older people would say, because you had just become part of what was, and they would say, Eileen, when did you become part of the scene? And I don't know that anybody calls the poetry world a scene anymore. And there was this sense, it was kind of this post-Warhol sense that we weren't necessarily on the set of a movie, but it felt like we were. So the cameras could be rolling at any point or already were rolling. And it was like this collective memory, which was the institution of the time, not an institution that could decide whether you were right or wrong and let you in or not let you in, and then you may count or not count. It was this more sturdy thing, which I also talk about in the book, this capacity to hang out, you know, which I learned in high school and was a great pastime then and now.
Well, that was what was so brilliant, that you don't have to be good at poetry. You have to be good at observing the scene. And knowing, kind of making instant judgments.
And gathering riches from it. And people will come up, walk up to you and tell you this. But you have to decide whether this has value and this has value. And making that arrangement of – it's almost like arranging flowers. It's like making live choices that then become a poem and then become a kind of a literature of oneself.
You know, you make it clear here that in order to become the poet Eileen Miles, you had to find out who Eileen Miles was and who Eileen Miles would be. And although – your poetry is often in your own voice, that you had to figure out how to put it down on paper without corrupting it, without making it more poetic than it needed to be, or thinking that it wasn't enough, that it really was a course in learning how to be yourself on the page.
Which isn't still isn't exactly the same as being yourself. You know, there's that feeling often like after doing a reading where somebody will come up and say, well, what bus was that that you were talking about? Or I had that sexual experience too. It's sort of like I'm not really saying let's all share exactly, but I am saying let's all put a light on our own existence and understand that that's liberation itself. And that's the thing to write from. You know, is the capacity to see oneself while you're standing in the light. I really feel like the performance of existence is the bedrock of poetry, not the history of literature.
And what is the performance of existence?
Well, I think what we're doing here right now. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and take some notes, but I think that often that's what poets are doing on some level. For me, it really is about standing there in all the riches and realizing this is it, and I can't get all of this down. I'm not a movie camera. I'm actually something more subtle. You know, I can take a thought. I can take a phrase. I can take a shade of the wall. I can take a body heat. I can take a look in your eye and form a structure out of that. If I wasn't here in the deepest sense, I couldn't do that. So that the primary step is to be.
Now, what years does this encompass?
I guess it starts with about 68, and it goes on to close to 2000.
By the end of the book, you're just beginning.
Yes.
It takes your entire life to become a poet, every single minute of it, or at least every minute you remember. How do you do that? What's the difference between someone else's sentence and yours?
I don't know. I mean, sometimes I'm lucky. Sometimes I just get it down, and that's the right sentence. You know, I mean, I think that's part of the practice of being a poet is learning to hear yourself, you know, and that self that you're hearing isn't quite the same as the self that is walking down the street, but it is this kind of weird measure of your existence. And so it's just like I'm very practiced at that. But I also, you know, this book took 10 years. I'd say two or three of those involved publishing and finding the right agent and finding the right publisher and all that. So say 6 or 7 years. So there's a lot of editing, a lot of overwriting, a lot of throwing out and stuff. So in a way, there's an easy thing of writing the right sentence, and there's a not so easy thing, which is erasing the wrong sentence. I don't really hold up poets as these great, you know, I once had a conversation with a famous poet, and it was kind of a gathering of female poets at a poet's apartment, and thought that we should all meet each other. We were poets of different stripes and stuff. And this one very famous poet said to me, well, we're really the people who could say this thing because poets, you know, we have this access to truth. And I was like, do you really think that? I don't think that. I don't think we have our fingers on truth at all. I think it's something else entirely, you know. But I think we have the job of making something that seems true, that feels true. I mean, that's what verisimilitude means. What people like is something that feels true. They don't. So that's why I think it gets really messy, and it's part of why I didn't call it a memoir. I don't want to be held on account to whether these things actually happened, because most of them did, but some of them didn't, and some of them didn't happen like that. But I mean, sometimes when I look at my own existence and think, how could I have done that? I thought, because you have a life, because you're on a road, and the only way you know you could have a road is to not be on it. And then you got to get back on it. You got to get your ass back on that road.
I'm talking to Eileen Miles about Inferno, a poet's novel, and it is published by Or Books. And I think it's interesting and worth talking about that you took a risk that people are only beginning to take. This is publishing on demand.
Mm-hmm.
And tell me about what that is and why you chose to do it.
Well, the capacity to be radical, it winds up being part of the publisher's responsibility, part of the writer's responsibility, and part of the culture's responsibility. If books need to be written and read and distributed, like, it seems clear that we need to do something new. Like, I'm not a believer at all that the format of the book is over, you know. I mean, I think vinyl is the great argument for that, because we've seen in music that great formats don't die. I suspect that CDs will die, DVDs will die, because as we know, they're so awful. Even tapes might have been a little better, but vinyl doesn't, and books won't die. So I'm all for ebooks. I mean, I love that this publisher wanted to simultaneously publish it. And they were very clear, high-end print-on-demand, meaning, because I've had books that were in print suddenly start looking really bad. And when I asked the publisher, they were like, oh, we just realized that it was easier to change to print-on-demand. And I've seen great books, James Schuyler's Collected Poems is print on demand at this time. Mainstream publishers are doing this, but they don't do it in the first edition. They do it a few editions down. But the thing is, there are publishers who can make books look very good, just as good as any other book. But what we don't have to worry about is whether the first print run is 1,000 or 5,000. And basically, it goes right to the people, and we stop working with people like Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And I think every poetry publisher should be using this format. I mean, you know, I've met mainstream editors who love my work, and they've let me know that they would want to work very closely with me and sort of help this poor broken book. And I felt like that wouldn't be a good choice for me. I've always published in the independent press. And when I was about to publish this book, I could see that this one and this one and this one. And this seemed much more exciting to kind of like take a chance on this different rocket and see where it would take me. And it's been great, and it's been difficult in certain ways, because, you know, not all bookstores want to take a risk with it either. But people can just go to orbooks.com and get it, and that's kind of great.
Now, Inferno. What an annunciation. Uh-huh. Dante writes Inferno, and he's on a road too.
Uh-huh.
He says that he's midway on the road of life.
Right, right, right.
And he wakes up in the forest.
Mm-hmm.
And there are two ways to go. And, you know, suddenly this is going to be Dante pure and simple.
Uh-huh.
His love, Beatrice, who is his love in life. His guide, Virgil,
mm-hmm.
who was his guide in the idea of an epic of the life after this one. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, how does this connect to your Inferno?
Well, in so many ways. I mean, literally, you know, the beginning of the book describes encountering the book in college and also encountering a fierce female intellectual who happened to be hot, too. And it was a very effervescent experience after being somebody who went to Catholic schools for 12 years and to be suddenly in this radical pot, which was college, and all that knowledge coming at you in this new way. But also, like, Dante was banished. Dante was, you know, like, came from a great family, and he was a known poet, and then suddenly he was in Ravenna, which is, you know, this kind of one-horse town. He was stuck for the rest of his life. Oddly and interestingly, I wrote most of the book while I was a tenured professor, which doesn't come into this book at all. I had lived this life of being a poet, and suddenly the academy kind of brought its long hook and said, hey, do you want to come to San Diego and be a professor? I did do that, and suddenly I felt like I was, you know, melancholy Dante along the shores of the Black Sea or someplace, just, you know, whiling away the rest of my life, perhaps. And I knew I wasn't doing that, but I felt sort of snagged by the Academy, and it made me feel sort of melancholy. And I think it's the position of a lot of writers culturally right now. It's sort of like, how do we make a living? Well, the Academy, because do books ever sell enough copies for us to make a living doing exactly that? So there was that, where I was sort of in this warm pool for 4 or 5 years, where I sat there and wrote this book.
Well, one of the astonishing things, one of the connections, I'd say, is also Dante writes this book about who he finds in hell. Mm-hmm. And he's going to get in a lot of trouble, because he puts in hell a lot of people who were famous, a lot of people who were religious or political of his time. And he's essentially saying, hey, this is where they are. Right. In this book, too, many questions that can't be directly asked, like, how many people do you have to sleep with? Can you talk to them afterwards? Who are you after you've been with someone else who's another poet? And has there been a transfer of talent, of energy? What is the world like? And are you condemned for that? And will your friends blame you if you write about it? And how can you not write about it?
Right, exactly, exactly. All those are like the big questions in writing, period, whether you're writing something that's a memoir, romantic clef. It's sort of like there's all these different ways to write about where you've been. And also, you know, it's sort of like I wrote this in the 21st century, not the 20th century. So it's sort of about the other century. So it's kind of from the position of the future. And it's interesting. Like, I think that, like, my hell is the hell of being a female poet coming to New York. My purgatory is the career of the poet and trying to make a living. My heaven is the act of writing a poem and the act of becoming a lesbian, you know, and being a female who discovers love for the first time. And, I mean, one of the reasons I keep starting the book again and we keep finding ourselves in 1974 and 1975 is that I want to say that all these times are commingling. These are not, I mean, like, one of the ways that I distinguish myself as a contemporary person from Dante's time is that I think we know, particularly with media and all the ways we have of reproducing time and making it close and distant and next to you, and you know, and that we can watch the dead, you know, we can watch family movies, we can watch all, you know, this very little that we can't gain access to very quickly right now, and that all those times are in there together, and that's the road, you know.
I'm talking to Eileen Miles. She's the author, most recently, of the novel Inferno, a poet's novel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. You're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Eileen Miles about her new book, Inferno, a poet's novel. It's an amazingly funny, poignant, realistic, talky, beautifully paced, and improvised, or giving the impression of improvisation. Let's hear some of the beginning.
My English professor's ass was so beautiful. It was perfect and full as she stood at the board, writing some important word, reality or perhaps illusion. She opened the door. With each movement of her arms and her hand delicately but forcefully inscribing the letters intended for our eyes, her ass shook ever so slightly. I had never learned from a woman with a body before. Something slow, horrible, and glowing was happening inside me. I stood on the foothills to heaven. She opened the door. There were a bunch of us in Eva Nelson's world literature class who had gone to Catholic school. Nobody was that different. 18-year-old kids who had grown up going to the blessing of the fleet, hooting and drinking beer, who went to Sacred Heart, who played against Our Lady. Hardly anyone in the class was really that different. Everyone, it seemed to me, had lived in a roughly Catholic world. But those of us who knew nothing else, we were especially visible. When we had a thought, an exciting thought would go, st, st, like a batch of little snakes. We meant sister, Sister, pay attention to me. Call me now. Eva Nelson had been teaching Pirandello. What we really are considering here, and now she faced us with her wonderful breasts. I know that a woman, when she is teaching school, begins to acquire a wardrobe that is slightly different from her daily self, how she exposes herself to the world. For instance, later in the semester, I went to a party at our house in Cambridge, and she sat on her couch in her husband's shirt. He was a handsome and distant young man named Gary. He was the Nelson, and she wore his shirt, and you really couldn't see her breasts at all, but she had a collection of little jerseys, tan and peach, pale gold, and one was really white, I think. Generally, she dressed in sun tones, nothing cool, nothing blue. Nothing like the airy parts of the sky, but the hot and distant tones of the sun, and her breasts were in front of me. I was looking at her face, and I knew I was alive. On television, in my favorite shows, I had already begun to see how things could be slightly different. Or utterly different, like a man could flip his daily quarter towards a newsstand, and it would land just because it jounced against all the other shiny coins, and it landed on its edge. And all that day, the man could hear the thoughts of people on the street, his wife and his secretary, even his dog. It was crazy, and the next morning he threw this coin again. "Hey," said the regular Joe, who sold him the paper every day, "some guy did that yesterday, and I've been..." "Hey, you're that guy." The two guys' faces, really human faces, got big, and the music you never noticed till now, the music stopped playing. "Hey, you're that guy." "Yeah, it's me." There was something really covered about childhood. I think it was the nuns, with their pint of ice cream hats with the black, thick, flowing cloth that grazed the surface of the schoolyard in the old floors of my school. The nuns enclosed the world with sanity and God. The rules flowed up and down the calendar and around the clock and in the day, the sky. The world was rules, known by God, the nun said. Eva Nelson had fantastic breasts that jounced in her explanation of modernity, of no way out, of vagueness, of the burden of insecurity and the possibility of something else, that this could be a dream, all of it. If the flip of a coin could release a torrent of multivocal glee, well, maybe it was a dream. We didn't know. We couldn't. This was our condition. "The next book we will read," she said, pulling the shade on existentialism for the moment, "is a much older text. It's part of the tradition, but it's a very modern book, quite political." She had this cute glint when she was being smart, which was always. She wasn't big smart. She didn't clobber you with words. She just kind of befriended us like wolves. But she believed that wolves were good and could be taught, too. But she was from New York, was Jewish, and had been born intelligent. She was blonde. Are Jews blonde? I didn't know. I would learn so much more. Sometimes her jersey was nearly green, but that was as dark as it got. Dante really had no other way to talk about his time except in a poem. Inferno was a heavily coded poem. It's not about censorship, but something else. It was an age of not even satire, but allegory. His beliefs were fixed in the structure of his poem, like the windows of a church. Her eyes twinkled. "Oh, my God." And I'll give you a clue. She paused while she spoke so that each phrase could catch up in our thought. It wasn't like she thought we were dumb. I could feel her eyes meeting mine. "You're not dumb, Eileen." She knew me. And this was the best moment of all. Before any of the incidents that would change my life irrevocably, I felt she knew me. I sat in her class on Columbus Ave in the Salada Tea Building in Boston. On a Tuesday afternoon, I was seen, before words, before anything. She would pause and let the words catch up. We had time. "I want each of you to write an inferno." The class groaned. "It's just his time. This is yours." She smiled. It was ours now. I would show her my hell.
Eileen Miles, reading from the opening of Inferno, a poet's novel. I think any listener can hear the energy. How did you learn to put it on the page? Because I think a reader feels it, even one who doesn't hear or know your voice.
Well, you know, it's weird that I feel like it's more what we're doing right now, talking, and for me to read into a microphone and it be recorded and sent someplace else at some other time. In a weird way, that was the model for what I wanted to do in writing before I ever wrote. You know, I grew up in the age of Warhol and early 50s and 60s TV when people were doing live things in front of cameras. And I was very kind of a ham when I was a child. And, you know, early video and art museums where somebody would be standing there talking about their life. And I wanted to be all those characters, you know. So there was a sense of longing for a great recording of experience as I knew it. You know, there was the beautiful singer-songwriter moment of the 70s with Joni Mitchell and James Taylor, those beautiful lyric songs that were poems. So all of that stuff was kind of the experience that I was most moved by before I ever wrote a word. And when I finally hit my stride as a writer, first in poetry and then in prose, it was this actual performance of a thinking being, you know, looking inside, looking out, talking. The rhythm was the thing, which seemed beyond writing itself and was about pure sound and the incredible capacity we have in our era to record experience profoundly with technology. And that finally, you know, writing is this funky handmade version of all those technologies.
Now, to be that forward, right, and ballsy, why were you afraid, you say throughout the book, in being a lesbian, of the feelings you felt when you were looking at your teacher and all of that kind of thing?
Why was I afraid?
Why were you afraid?
Well, it was 1968. I came from a really repressive background that definitely sent a message that if there was such a freaky thing as lesbianism, it would turn you into a monster, surely, and it would not bring you closer to things you wanted. Though I didn't even know what those things were yet, but something like the world I'm in now. And, you know, it seemed like being a lesbian was like a big stumbling block on the road. And I had no examples, you know, of a woman being able to live this way and it bringing her to where she wanted instead of, in fact, we even had lesbians in the house I grew up in. We were a two-family working-class house in the suburbs outside of Boston, and my mother evicted these two drunken dykes for having fights in my apartment, and one of them being this lazy-ass artist who sat around all day painting. And, you know, so it's just like I didn't think that who I was inside would take me to where I wanted to go outside.
And what are the things that let you be who you are?
You know, I mentioned in here someplace somebody offering me a job selling life insurance to artists. And this guy said, what you need is a master list. And I was like, a master list? What's that? And he was like, everybody you know. People sometimes ask me who is my Virgil, you know. And of course, Virgil's my Virgil because I read a lot of Dante to write this book. But when I read the Aeneid, I thought, oh my God, this is the book. I mean, Virgil is incredible. I'm much more excited about Virgil than Dante. But the woman who was my teacher was my Virgil. You know, my dog, Rosie, who occurs in this book, was my Virgil. But everybody I ever met, and certainly all the poets I met, and the way all those impossible lives that failed and survived and just, you know, bred each other. The texture of that was how I learned to be me.
I've been talking with Eileen Miles, author most recently of Inferno, a poet's novel published by Aura Books. Thank you, Eileen, for coming.
Oh, thank you, Michael.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program or embed it on your blog, share it with a friend with a click of a button on our media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. Our new co-producer is Connie Alvarez. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm. He is a bookworm. She is a bookworm. We are all bookworms. I am a bookworm. We are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.